Let's review the status quo. In other words, what is the current condition in Canada, economically speaking, in terms of money, money supply, and how does this affect the day-to-day life of the typical Canadian?
We're essentially caught in an inflationary bubble caused by the compounding of interest charges on financial paper, be it mortgages, credit card agreements, car loans, etc., etc. Generally speaking, every piece of consumer financial paper in Canada falls into one of two categories. The first is what is called the fictitious consideration. For example, this is Van City Savings and Credit Union. It says, in consideration of Van City agreeing to establish a credit line and agreeing to lend to the member up to the total sum shown below, the member and Van City agree as follows. Provision 1 states, agreement to loan. Subject to the terms and conditions herein contained, Van City shall lend to the member up to the authorized limit and such further advances, etc., etc. But under Provision 6 of the same contract, it states, no obligation to advance. The member acknowledges and agrees that neither the execution of this credit line agreement nor execution and delivery of any security shall bind Van City to advance, but nevertheless the estate conveyed to Van City by any security shall take effect upon the execution and delivery of such security.
Okay, now could you translate that into normal sentences for our listening audience?
Okay, in layperson's terms, what that says is that let's assume that this is a $100,000 line of credit. The contract states on its face that you agree that Van City has done nothing for you and is not obligated to do anything for you, and in return, you agree that you owe them $100,000. What they're trying to conceal from you is the fact that your paper, your agreement that you owe them unconditionally $100,000, regardless, is the money that funds the account. And that's what they're trying to conceal from you. On this particular case, you have two levels of fraud. Assume that you sign this thing and you walk out of the office and you have a heart attack or you're hit by a bus or something. Theoretically, you have just agreed that you owe them $100,000 even though they have given you nothing. And so you're out $100,000 and they're up $100,000. And that's how it actually works. The first thing they will teach any student in law school is that this is an anti-contract. It literally states that you agree that you owe them $100,000 for nothing, and it is unenforceable on its face. Now, you are vulnerable to them realizing on that contract between the time you sign it and they actually do advance, assuming that they do. And under a number of Supreme Court decisions in Canada, that vulnerability or that exposure to that risk constitutes the closing element of a fraudulent act. That they have committed fraud, no question, and in two different ways on the face of this contract. The other alternative is that the contract will state on its face that it is a receipt for loan proceeds already delivered, when that statement is categorically false, and you can demonstrate that. You say, well, excuse me, Mr. Banker, you had me sign an agreement or a receipt stating that you had already delivered the loan proceeds to me, because that receipt is itself the money for the account.
This is the situation that you described earlier as the case with a mortgage.
The case with a mortgage.
The mortgage you sign, you're in your closing, and you sign this that you've received the money, and you have not yet received the money.
Right.
That hasn't been transferred.
It also states that you're already the registered owner. Now, if you're already the registered owner, then what do you want the loan for? It's fairly blatant.
It seems very interesting that this amount of slack or carelessness is permitted in these very legal documents, because the picture that we have of the law is it's just the opposite. There is no slack and everything is precise, precise, precise. But here you're saying that it's merely the appearance of precision. In fact, there is a conscious obfuscation going on to make it legally imprecise in such a way that it constitutes fraud.
Yes.
And so that's a rather shocking revelation for me as an average person.
You got to realize it. No competent lawyer acting in good faith would allow their client to sign such a document without turning to them and saying, well, hey, wait a minute, is this true before you sign? Have you in fact already received the loan proceeds? And you would say, no, well, wait a minute. The point being that the lawyer is obviously a part of this larger fraud. And so we find ourselves in a position where technically and strictly speaking, there isn't a loan contract in Canada that's worth the paper it's printed on.
And you say this has been tested in court and proven several times to be vulnerable to being called into question like this.
Oh, absolutely. And it scares them to death because they know that you're right. It's a type of fraud you don't realize until somebody points it out. I always liken it to one of those Where's Waldo games. You have this little cartoon character buried in this sea of complexity, and the game is to see if you can find where he is. But the flaw in this type of game, so to speak, is that once somebody says, no, there he is, and points out where Waldo is hiding, the next time you go back, there's no fun anymore.
Exactly.
Because your eye immediately jumps to where he is, etc. So we're faced collectively with this problem that all the paper is on its face absurd, unenforceable, it is a fraud in law, and it is a fraud against equity. Because you got cheated out of the equitable substance that you brought to the transaction. The bank brought nothing to the transaction, but left with $100,000. You brought $100,000 to the transaction and left with nothing. Now, if they do later advance you the $100,000, then you owe them a further $100,000 plus interest on it. You see, you really do arrive with $100,000 at the transaction and leave with nothing.
Let's say I sign an agreement of this to open up a line of credit at your bank, and 30 days elapses, and then I start to exercise the line of credit and I withdraw the full $100,000, or activate or use or put into motion my use of the $100,000. Now you say I'm liable for it twice?
Yes. You have brought the $100,000 of financial paper, which the bank recognizes as money or money equivalent. They write in their own books that John Smith today gave us $100,000.
So 30 days ago when I signed it,
yes.
I created that.
And they write in their books in their asset column, we received $100,000 from John Smith. Now, when you go back and you actually draw on this line of credit, all they're doing is returning your own equity to you from your deposit account, only they call it a loan account. And now you have to pay it back to them with interest. And so you end up paying it to them twice. And if you count the interest, you can be paying them the same monies up to four times. That is sort of the fuel for this inflationary bubble that we are living under. So we're faced with this very large problem. It's really disequity. You've heard the term inequity.
Yes.
Okay. Inequity means unfair financially. And the courts are generally not concerned with inequity. The courts won't look behind the transaction to see whether you made a good deal or a bad deal, but they will not enforce a grossly inequitable contract. But here we're dealing with a further escalation of disequity. And that means that if you bring to them $100,000, then you will owe them $100,000. If you give them $1 million, then you owe them $1 million. So that the more money you give to them, the more you owe them. So you are in fact dealing with disequity.
Let me ask you one other question about this, which is that having seen Waldo, having seen that this is what's going on, if you were to bring this up as an issue, what would the result be if you were to, in a sense, challenge this?
Okay, if you go into court by yourself, or let's say you go in to see your banker, he's going to deny it. He's going to say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. The essential problem is that they are allowed, or they've been getting away with trafficking in unfunded liabilities. I mean, in terms of currency, there's no government-issued currency behind their transactions. They're allowed to use your money as the equity of the transaction and bypass the legal tender system. So this scares them. They've been getting away with it for so long, and they owe so much money if they had to pay it back, or they've obtained from people so much equity without any real consideration that from their point of view, it would be a collapse or some sort of calamity if someone were to sort of blow the whistle on it and say, okay, no, this is going to end, and so there would be a problem. Now, let's say you go in with 10 people together, then they've got a bigger problem, but they have to deal with it. Say that the Royal Bank of Canada happens to hold the mortgage on 10 square city blocks, every single residence, in a certain section of Winnipeg, for example. Well, if every one of those people were to go in as a group and say, we demand a remedy. We understand what you've done to us. We are not interested in causing chaos. We simply want to get our due. We want to get back the property that you tricked us out of. And this used to be called theft by a trick. That was the early English law explanation of it. It's now called fraud. But there was a specific form where somebody would have a complex transaction and they would get your property seemingly by contract, but you would look to some underlying fraud. Fraud vitiates all contracts from their inception. And so essentially what we're dealing with here is, in a sense, it's something that is difficult to predict because it's never happened before. No 100 people have ever gone in collectively to some branch in downtown Winnipeg and put them to the test.